In 1999, Quebec nurses went on strike, but after 22 days, their action was declared illegal. 10 years before, women faced even worse legal maneuvering, when striking nurses lost 1 year of seniority for every day of the illegal strike. Just last fall, 80,000 teachers throughout Quebec walked out, and again, essential services laws were cited and teachers forced back to work.
In North America, the Industrial Revolution came through women workers.
Over the next 4 weeks, we'll take up these issues here on CKUT's Long-Term Memory Radio Project, Women's Labor History in Quebec and Canada, every Wednesday from 5 to 6 p.m., concluding on May Day.
Women have always been essential to the labor movement. The first unions that were formed by male-skilled workers who weren't admitting those women.
Hearts starve as well as bodies. Give us bread, but give us roads.
Welcome to part 3 of Women's Labor History in Quebec and Canada. Previously on this series, we spoke with Lillian Robinson, principal of Simone de Beauvoir Institute, about the early craft union and the organizing and networking of women. In part 2, we spoke with Micheline Dumont about the industrial unions in the 30s and 40s and an important women's leader. Today on part 3, we're going to speak with Professor Maria Peluso, who is the president of the Concordia Part-Time Faculty Association and also a very popular teacher at Concordia University. She will speak about the 60s, the public sector union, and on up to today. Maria Peluso also looked at women's unpaid work. We'll talk about Europe and the solidarity needed to achieve collective bargaining and about the role that migrant workers played in Canadian history.
Bury me in my overalls, don't use my gabardines. Bury me in my overalls or in my beat-up jeans. Give my suit to Uncle Jake, he can wear it at my wake and bury me in my overalls. The undertaker will get my dough, the grave will get my bones. What is left will have to go for one of those granite stones. But this suit cost me 2 weeks' pay, so let it live another day and bury me in my overalls. Oh, bury me. Don't use my gabardines. Bury me.
Professor Maria Peluso, welcome.
Thank you.
So we're going to talk a little bit here about the 60s and how the public sector was a very important turn in getting women unionized, and especially for nurses and for teachers, and having a strong union, and how also the government came down afterwards on them and trying to take those rights away.
Well, I can't agree with you more. The 60s was a time when many people became empowered in so many ways, and I may add not only in the labor movement. And it also marked an acceptance of the choices women were making, which was very, very distinct and different from the role of the housewife and queen of the home in the 50s. It was the beginning of women's liberation. Women were demanding to be recognized. So it coincided quite nicely with a lot of other social movements that were taking place.
It's
peace
the
movement, the environment movement, the women's movement,
that's
the anti-war.
That's the second wave of feminism.
Yeah.
And some women are also reading Betty Friedan books, The Feminine Mystique, and questioning their role as housewife and you know, they have experienced, some of them, the Second World War and working in the factories and having a salary, and all of a sudden being dependent on men's salary. There are some women are questioning that, and they have the skill too because they went to school, so they want to go back on the labor market. And the idea that women can have her place on the labor market, because women have always worked, this new idea that they had to stay home, you know, is being questioned. question again. Eventually, the fact that they can go back on the labor market in such a big proportion kind of also brought up the idea that, yes, they should unionize, and there is important woman leaders in the union movement in Quebec, especially Simone Monet-Chartrand and Madeleine Parent were also playing an important role.
And not only that, I think all the syndicats centrales or the federations, the CSN and the FTQ and the DSN and many, even at the Canadian level, the Canadian Labour Congress were ensuring that women had some kind of parity or equity on their executives so that there were women being given an opportunity to get involved in actually setting and establishing the priorities for things like collective negotiations, collective bargaining, where many of the issues that affect women's working conditions are going to be made, those kinds of decisions, that what is it that we should fight for when we're negotiating at the table. And so by putting women in definite positions of power and in definite positions within the union structures, especially for the large federations, had an incredible impact at being able to improve. I think the biggest success, and I really admire them a great deal, because there were not too many women at the executive level, but yet there were many, many women that worked in the offices and in the clerical end, was the Canadian Union of Postal Workers. They were one of the first to fight for maternity leave,
yes,
which is amazing when you think that, you know, that
now we
they
take
would
that
do this.
For granted.
Yes,
but,
we take that for granted, and we're still so far behind Europe. We still do not like children. We still do not like, we think we like the family. But we really don't do anything to support that family. And that's a very good example. So women's lives have gotten a little better, but not as much as we'd like to believe.
Third wave of unionization is really an important one regarding the demands that are specifically for women.
Things have taken a backward turn, I would say, in the last, I guess ever since the election of Ronald Reagan, Margaret Thatcher, and Brian Mulroney, and it's just been a continuation of dismantling the 80s and the dirty 90s, you know, of dismantling of all those gains that were made. They're being dismantled. You'd be amazed to find out how much of the Quebec labor market is contingent. That is to say, part-time, temporary work, contract work, seasonal work, work which is insecure, largely because employers, and particularly the public sector, really do not wish to pay any prorated benefits. And I was quite surprised that 40% of the labor market is contingent or precarious. Mm-hmm. And in some places in the United States, 60%. I'm organizing, in fact, a major conference in the first weekend of October in Montreal on contingent academic labor. But whether we look at nurses, whether we look at teachers, whether we look at Bell Canada, whether we look at any industry, there is an ever more increasing number of part-time. Majority of them have always been women. And there's been a lot of discrimination that women as part-time workers have had to face. Many of them could not find full-time jobs, and many of them chose part-time work because they were mothers, and they had to combine supporting themselves and supporting a family. But just as an example, there's the Kelly Lusick case, and she was a part-time nurse that was being denied unemployment insurance because the federal government had changed the requirements for unemployment insurance. I don't know why they call it employment insurance now, if that isn't a big brother, double speak kind of concept. Either you're employed or you're not, but to call it employment insurance. But they changed how you calculate that, and you calculate that by the number of hours. Well, what this means is that you need at least 700 hours of work in order to collect. And yeah, 700.
900
for you? Yeah. Well, it changes from region to region and from 900 hours. Well, if you work part-time, I mean, you're never going to be able to get this amount that you need. So she successfully argued before the courts that this was against the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. It discriminated against part-time workers. There was nothing that was prorated to consider part-time work, which is an amazing decision. I don't think it's over. I think it's going to be appealed, and it's going up, before the Supreme Court. And, of course, there's the Gosselin case before the Supreme Court, the Canadian Supreme Court, a woman who was told she had to take training, a young mother, but she didn't qualify for the training. But if she didn't take the training, she was going to be cut off her welfare, which they did because she didn't take the training, but they didn't know that she didn't qualify. She claimed it was discrimination because of her age, and you had to be a certain age in order to take this training. So the Gosselin case, which will be coming up hopefully this spring, is another interesting case. But it's been very, very slow. You'd be amazed at how far we've gone behind. You would think that with a charter and with all kinds of pay equity, that Bell Canada would not oppose the idea of pay equity for their telephone operators. Well, let me tell you what they've done, Bell Canada. Bell Canada now has operators that work in the United States, so that when you call for directory assistance, you may not get an operator who lives and is from Montreal or Quebec. This is part of the globalization, I think, of the labor market. They hire somebody part-time somewhere else, and through the technology, they don't have to worry about pay equity. And so many of the operators, Bell Canada operators, were out of work and were laid off. I love Bell Canada operators. They were the first people to ever go out on strike in the Winnipeg strike of 1919. They were the first women. They were the first people to go out on strike, which was a general strike in Canada's history. It was started by Bell Canada operators.
A movie was made by the NFP a few years ago. Bell Canada was trying to give the work to contractors, again, to avoid benefits. Of course, this was a discriminatory attempt, because of course operators is mostly women. The gentlemen that were repairing the lines, which is another sector within Bell Canada, they were given all their benefits, even if they didn't ask, because there was a big fear of merger. Bell operators were afraid that they would lose the benefits that they had fought for and that they felt deserved, and they wanted to make sure that within the merger they would keep their working condition. And what happened is that they lost. However, the technicians, they got guaranteed that within the merger they would remain or keep their working condition and benefit, even if they didn't ask it. So there was tremendous discrimination and bias within the fear of the merger, and it was, again, the woman's...
Who suffered that.
So
we cannot ignore the impact of globalization. It's happening a lot in the media, in the journalism section. Because this idea of convergence and these mergers and these amalgamations, well, I'll give you an example. The Montreal Gazette used to have flex time, which was great if you're a woman journalist, because you could organize your career and your family and your responsibility, your life, mm-hmm. around the things that mattered to you and still do a terrific job. Mm-hmm. Well, they got rid of flex time. So if you're a mother, you have young children, they force these women to work part-time. Mm-hmm. And that way they don't have to pay any of the prorated benefits. You know, during the 60s and early 70s, all those gains that were important inch by inch by inch have been slowly clawed back. Our pensions are being clawed back. Our health services are being clawed back.
Dental plans,
education. If you're not paying greater tuition fees, I couldn't believe it. Somebody was telling me tuition fees to go to school in Ontario is $6,000 per year and up. It's user fees. And this has an impact on the accessibility of women being able to go to school, being able to have training, being able to be treated equally. Let's not forget that I can't believe that a society that has been so patriarchal, that when it comes to deficit cutting and budgets and all these, I call it bogus language that the governments use, that it is women and children first who become affected. and 2 million children under the age of 16 are living below the poverty line in this country. 70% of all the women on welfare are single mothers because they can't afford daycare. There's no national daycare system in this country yet.
I've lived a life of privilege. I've never known what hunger is. I've never labored with my hands except to play guitar. Middle class, my middle name. Life's been more or less a game, but in the end it's all the same. The buck stops where you are, and we are foolish people who do nothing, because we know how little one person can do. Yes, we are foolish people who do nothing, because we know how little one can do. It's not my issue, not my scene. I've got to get my own house clean. I keep it neat and tidy just in case the queen should call. Come back to me another day and gladly I'll join in, we say. And I'm just one voice anyway, just one brick in the wall. One brick in the wall, you may be one voice in the crowd, but without you we are weaker and our song may not be heard. One drop in the ocean, but each drop will swell the tide. So be a one brick in the wall, be one voice in the crowd.
I don't know if you'll agree with me, but there seems to be, since the beginning of this series, a pattern. Every time there seems to be a financial crisis or instability, we send back women to their home. After the first, you know, during the First World War, women went into the factories. They needed workers. They offered national daycare. They offered assistance, and women enjoyed for the first time, you know, a real good salary for their work, a salary that is equal to the quality of the work that they were providing. After the First World War, there was the Depression. Women had to, you know, scrape and help the family go by. And they said to women, well, you know, the good soldiers that were patriotic and are coming back to the country, they need to have work, so they sent women back home. Second World comes around and women go back in the factories again, make good salaries, and they provide the conditions so that women can work again with national daycare and other system like this. And then there's a creation of this scientific mothering and the whole mystique that women should be at home and be a good mother and send back women back in their home. And then the 60s, finally, women with the second wave of feminism wake up and said, well, wait a minute here, you know, we are entitled to work just as much. And here comes, you know, the 80s and again, financial crisis, and we're sending back. We're not sending literally woman back home, but we're making sure that they're...
We're making sure that she remains in the gutter. And I think a good illustration of that is the wonderful work of François David with La Fédération des Femmes du Québec and La Marche, you know, the Bread and Roses March on Poverty, was really hit the nail on the head. That you're absolutely right in what you say, that I guess they can't send us back home to have babies because we have contraception and we can make choices, whether it's abortion, whether it's having children, whether it's not having children, whether it's adopting children, whether it's raising children by ourselves, with a partner, with a man, without a man. We have that freedom, but what it has done is it's made sure that women have remained in the economic gutter. Mm-hmm. And so it's only increased the poverty. And I think this was a major leadership taken by La Fédération des Femmes du Québec. You know, I was very proud to be a woman here in Quebec and here in Canada too, that we took some international leadership on the issue on the March on Poverty against women.
I think we're realizing how the economic situation and the setback within work for women and I'm talking here with Professor Maria Peluso. When you realize that women don't feel they have the economic situation and stability to have children, when women wants to have children and are talking to each other and saying, hey, I can't, I'm too poor. We are too poor and still putting together 40, 50 hours a week with, you know, combining two or three part-time jobs, mm-hmm. having sometime a degree or some education, but thinking, well, you know, we have two years of waiting list for a $5 daycare. How are we going to scrape by? You know, I'm too poor to have children. So that's how much society loves kids.
Well, you know, what you say... I think the Journal de Montréal this morning did a nice little exposé because Diane Lavallée issued out a report on the statue of adolescents, the status of adolescent girls. And what she's discovered is that they're having sexual relations a lot younger, but they're staying at home a lot longer. And they almost, it's like a paralysis. They can't see themselves in terms of a work environment. And when they do enter the working environment, they still suffer the same inequity that women have always suffered. It's just amazing. So whether you're talking about young women or the women who have children already, you know, or you're talking about the elderly woman, you know, who can't get a job because she's between the ages, I don't know, of 45 and 55. And there's a lot of women who are homeless in that age group, or the elderly woman who's not wanted because we still have a lot of ageism as well as sexism still in this society, that it's amazing that, in fact, the situation of women has not improved as much as we'd like to believe, which is how I started mm-hmm. our conversation. I mean, on a certain level, it looks good on paper, but in the nitty-gritty of the quality of women's lives, I'm not sure how much has really changed. I like the sense that I'm liberated and that you're liberated and that I think all, I hope anyway, men, women, I think people are more liberated today in terms of making personal choices. Mm-hmm. That's great. It's nice to be free and to know that you can be accepted no matter what your sexuality or what choices you make in life, but not in the economic realm. And so we really desperately need a social charter in this country. And we need to look at what Europe has done, you know, in terms of maternity leave, in terms of some of the programs that are offered there.
It's good that you bring Europe in the conversation because there's two things I wanted to mention and maybe discuss with you, especially about the financial situation of women. For example, there's a lot of single mothers that had a divorce, a separation with their husband, and, you know, the ex-partner, or the father of the kid anyway, is supposed to, according to the court, pay an alimony to the wife, the ex-wife, or just for the kids. Will not ask for that amount of money, which is like a survival amount of money. What happened here in Quebec and Canada is that it's up to the men, even if there's a court order, to send the check or give the cash money to the wife. However, there's still a lot of violence between couples, because it's almost like it's out of fashion to talk about it, but there is still out there a lot of violent ex-husband or partner. In Europe, the alternative is that whatever amount that the ex-partner is supposed to pay will be paid by the government, and it's the government's responsibility, or the government takes that responsibility on running after the partner or ex-husband on getting the cash. And if, for example, the partner just, you know, disappear, run away, go in prison, you know, or, you know, do bankruptcy or something, the government still takes an engagement into paying that amount of money because it's important for single mothers supporting the family family that they get the resources. So, you know, it's such an easy solution, and yet we're so behind into taking that step that would help women tremendously.
But part of the problem in Canada that doesn't exist maybe in France is because Canada is a federation and the maintenance and support payments are administrated by the provinces. It makes it very difficult, and particularly if you have a deadbeat father, say, for example, or you could even have a deadbeat mother, but a deadbeat parent who leaves the province, and it was a nightmare. There have been some improvements, very tiny. For example, now the Quebec government will not hesitate to garnish the wages if there is un recours légal, you know, against somebody who has not paid their child support payments, and they will garnish the wages, which I think is good. There's also been greater cooperation between the provinces. So if some guy leaves Montreal and goes and live in Vancouver, it doesn't mean that he can forget about his responsibilities, which is good. But I agree with you, the best solution, you know, instead of establishing all these damn bureaucracies and means test to establish who deserves welfare, maybe what we should do is take that money and make sure that people who are owed, women who are owed their maintenance payment for their children, are going to be given it. And maybe the money should be spent trying to police the people who need to provide this money, you know, mm-hmm. to their families. You know, it's still very problematic, this whole issue of child support. But there have been a few positive changes. Mm-hmm. You know, both parents are now responsible for the maintenance of their common offspring, like whether you're married or whether you're living common law. I think that's important because it acknowledges the right of the child. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you look at the history that this country in pre-Confederation starts out where only men had custody of the children because children and women, wives, were property. And so when you had a divorce, the children automatically went to the father. This is well into Canadian history, into the mid-1950s. You know, and then slowly, well, if the mother was a fit parent, we could give her children. And then it went the other extreme, where automatically all the children went to the woman, you know. But again, there was no support payments. And as you say, you know, in Europe, they handle this by not increasing the stress, the personal stress of confronting somebody who has not paid you. France has made incredibly things in the last 2 or 3 years. I love what they've done for women in politics too. They,
right.
You know, they've really put the pedal to the metal and want to make sure that there's going to be 50% of those elected will be women, which is amazing. I'm amazed.
I want to ask you, have you seen the movie Bread and Roses that came out 2 years ago? It talks about cleaners in Los Angeles of, you know, skyscraper building, and a lot of them are immigrant coming from Mexico or other places in the world, and how we came to believe that a little bit is better than nothing, and just, you know, agreeing to work with almost no condition. That, as we mentioned before, in the 60s and 70s, it was hard fought for within unions that workers would have some support and benefit.
Yeah, because a whole other discussion
right.
that I was terribly involved with because of the migrant workers. I was terribly involved with in the 60s and 70s with the farm workers union and the Chicanos and Mexicans. Grape boycott and the lettuce boycott. To this day, I still don't eat grapes or buy California wine. But these people had a dream that they were sold largely by companies like Del Monte and the United Fruit Growers and other American corporations to come to America. And the idea that, consider Mexico, 60% of the male population is unemployed. Anything is better than that. It's believable that even if you're washing windows, because then you'd have an opportunity to at least be better than where you were. And you are better than where you were because it's so devastating in terms of the third world conditions that the majority of Mexican men and women and children have to grow up with, that even in the film Bread and Roses, you take for granted that, as you say, that this is an incredible opportunity when in fact it isn't.
Mm-hmm. But it raised a question about the situation of women, you know, migrant workers that come in Quebec or in Canada working within families to take care of the kids, to clean the houses.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's been historical in Canadian history that whether you want to call them, which is very fascinating from an economic and political point of view, what is the definition of a slave? But throughout Canadian history, women have always been brought. Well, first of all, we couldn't convince any decent woman in her right mind to come to Canada in the first place. So in order to attract anyone we could get, I guess the domestic program in immigration was always a major program, and it still is today. It still is. Nothing has changed there. That one way that you can come in to this country is as a domestic worker. The only good thing is that at least you can come in as a single woman. At one time, you could never come in unless, well, your father was with you or you were sold or, you know, you were married, and then you could come with your husband and immigrate into the country. But the exploitation still exists, and there's a wonderful organization called Au Bas de l'Echelle that works exactly on this issue and just this issue. You know, well, I shouldn't say just this issue as if that, you know, to demean it.
But they focus on
the immigrant domestic Au Bas de l'Echelle. I mean, you know, just unpaid work or work that's not paid properly. And the abuse that takes place, the sexual abuse that takes place, the fear that if you don't, you know, clean the kitchen the way you should, there will be a report to the immigration officer and you could be sent back. I mean, that kind of menacing environment. It's like always you're working with those fears. You're working with fear, you know?
And I see that at the same time as really inherent to this condition of women is that home. Home has been a place where women have done, you know, historically a lot of work and participation. Whether it is housewife who cleans the home, who raise their kids in the home, or a lot of women have done historically work at home. And the fact that home is feared that they control in, you know, most of the case is at the same time kind of a paradox because they are isolated. Men going at the factories, they have one working environment. They have one location where they all meet. They can all speak at lunchtime, you know, in front of their sandwich or whatnot. They can organize as when women were doing peace work at home. It is harder for them to organize because where are they going to go to organize? What are they going to do with the kids? Are they going to provide daycare facilities while you have like union meeting, things like that?
That's so typical of the immigrant mindset of women, immigrant women who believe that it's a real good deal to be able to do work at home, you know, usually as a seamstress and take care of children. Many of them end up being very, very miserable and then give up very... They don't last a long time doing that because taking care of children is a full-time occupation in itself. You can't sort of do that. You can't do that a little bit. It's a total thing.
Oh, yeah, and the kids who are there to remind you that.
That's right. I mean, they're not going to let mommy. So a lot of these women were sort of taking care of their children and found that they would work late at night when the family was sleeping. It didn't work out. For many of them, it doesn't work out what they imagine. Mm-hmm. It sounds like a good idea, again, you know, conceptually. Oh, well, this is neat. I can work at home and work by taking care of the children at the same time. But it's pretty intensive work, piecework. And you get paid for every item that you do. And usually you do have a boss who's horrid. They may not give you the proper materials or they may not pay you the amount that you should be paid. This is one of the lacunas, I think, of the union movement, actually, in the textile union, which I've complained about. They really ought to do something. A lot of these women who work at home, incidentally, work under the black market. In other words, nobody knows that they're working there. And in Quebec...
And it's not because they want to be bad citizens.
No, no, not at all. But it's the black market because the employer...
Keeps it that way.
Keeps it that way. And you'd be amazed how many things are sold in Zellers and the Bay and that have been made by women in this way. They've even got trailers out in Vaudreuil of women just in a trailer sewing on snowsuits for kids and sewing snowsuits.
Vaudreuil, Quebec.
Yeah.
Yeah, not third world country.
Not third
right
world
here
country.
In our backyard.
Right here in our backyard.
Children of the revolution coming out to play. Bombers ripped the night apart and blew the school away. Some live on the south side and they overlook the water. Some live on the north side and they're looking at the border. And those children of the revolution see the soldiers come, smiling at the widows as they take away the sons. Children of the revolution shot down with a brand new gun. Now they're dropping down like flies, and in their eyes the images of war are in their eyes. They've seen it all before and know all lies. Won't keep their bellies full in love and war. Children of the revolution getting off the boat to face the ignorance and prejudice that keep this land afloat. Children of the revolution make a brand new start, running through the rubble of a thousand broken hearts. And in their eyes all promises are broken. In their eyes the words that can't be spoken end your life. Don't keep their bellies full in love and war. There are no rules but in their eyes. Murder comes by sea and from the skies. It's shiny and it's quick to take their lives. And if it's cruel in love and war, there are no rules. Someone sells a gun and someone blows them all away, yeah. Children of the revolution sold out by the banks, who swap the green upon the dollars for the green upon the tanks. Children of the revolution shot down by brand new guns. Shot down by brand new.
Talk about unpaid work that women do, and a little bit about your experience with Marilyn Warren. Her great film, Who's Counting? Maybe as a society, look at that and try to value it and give it a prize.
Well, I think that the first thing that has to be said is about Marilyn Waring's thesis. It's a political, economic, and I would say mainly economic, understanding of the world. And most of us, and I have to agree with Marilyn Waring, suffer from economic anxiety. We feel a little stupid. if we know nothing about economics, because there's a lot of numbers. And so we tend not to get involved. And one of the things that I like about Marilyn Waring is how easy she makes economics accessible. And I guess she changed my whole view of even looking at economics, but I had never reflected on the fact that we do have a cash economy. The only thing that has value is when cash is exchanged. If there's no cash that gets exchanged, then it's not recorded anywhere. It's not in a country's national system of accounts. You don't appear anywhere. Now, the significance of this is that if you do valuable work, and I can think of many people, fathers, mothers, volunteers, who do tremendous work, and yet that's never tabulated in a country's gross domestic product because it's never calculated. There's no cash. Mm-hmm. So there's something wrong with how we've set up this economic system in terms of imparting value.
And what they do, it's worth to mention, is crucial to the good functioning of this society, is that, you know, with the volunteer, just the volunteer work, it has like a tremendous value in millions of dollars of work that is being done by volunteers.
Something like $16 billion a year in Canada on volunteers alone.
Yes.
And for mothers and fathers who are caregivers, we're looking there close to $80 billion.
Yeah, and caregiver, we have an aging population. It's not only for the young kids anymore. It's often supporting
It's lifelong caring. Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely. I just hope there's somebody to take care of me. Well, we should organize. I hope that people my age, after all, because we're children of the 60s, maybe we will have the return of gray power, you know, because there was a group in the 60s of older people that were senior citizens that called themselves gray power. There is a group. Well, let me tell you, I can't wait. Because maybe we'll have a lot more energy, certainly, to be able to continue. My generation was a generation that was born with its boots on, and it'll probably die with its boots on.
Well, I hope so, and that you'll pass the example to the younger generation, too, because the union have got maybe some bad reputation 10 years, mainly probably because of the right wing.
Well, let's be
agenda. Fair.
That's true. But also, you have to keep in mind, only one third of the Canadian labor market is unionized. If you read the papers and the selective agenda setting by the mainstream media, you would think that we were under siege every time somebody goes on strike. You know, unfortunately, one third of the Canadian labor market is unionized. We're not even talking about 50%. It's very hard for the union movement to expand. They make it very difficult for you to even certify as a union. There's going to be a provincial election here in this province. The Quebec Liberals would like to revamp the labor code, almost making it virtually impossible, clawing back more rights in the labor area.
Impossible to
Unionize. It's
yes.
Even difficult now. Just look at what those poor young people have tried to do with McDonald's as an example.
Try to fight a corporation and you'll, you know, face a wall.
Or the government, because the law, the way they set the law up for union certification is virtually impossible. It's easier to start a corporation than it is to start a union. Now, there's something wrong with a society that does not acknowledge labor as being equally as important as profit and money, because there is a link between the two.
Mm-hmm. Even in places that we thought was good working condition, which is namely the CBC here in Canada, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, there's a strike that's been going on for more than a week now. Actually, it was a strike at first, and then it became a lockout. So we didn't. We don't talk about lockout, but it's the employers that are keeping the employees that have been striking to get better working condition. Because again, globalization made it that instead of giving some permanency to the journalists, as you have mentioned,
is
keeping them part time.
Well, no thanks to Global Communications and the Aspers, who don't miss an opportunity ever to criticize public broadcasting in the first place, that have reaffirmed the kind of right-wing agenda of how much and that people should be paid and how workers should be treated. It certainly hasn't helped in this current strike with the CBC. Those CBC technicians, the reporters, the workers deserve every single Canadian support, because it is one of the most superior radio and television broadcasting studios in the world, on the same level, I would say, as BBC and the ABC in Australia. It's a public broadcasting, and that's quality to be able to have that. And yet they have had continual interference. Corporate interference, more advertising, less and less local programming and control over community reporting. It's ridiculous, you know, that we get all the news now at 6 o'clock from some national body. And yet we had a very vibrant Montreal studio, local studio, so cutbacks that have been done. And this is absolutely, and much the same things that they did with the National Film Board. One time I was really touched and disturbed that you had gone to the National Film Board, Bianca, and you couldn't see any of the films for free. I mean, after all, our taxpaying dollars generously, and I want to continue to generously support the National Film Board. How dare they turn around and treat you as a customer?
Mm-hmm. Right.
In that way, you know what I'm saying? Like, I'm shocked and appalled, and I think people should write the government. I'm not going to leave your program without suggesting that anyone who's listening to me must, right now, immediately, take down a pen and paper and write letters of protest. Don't ever think that your word and what you can do will have no meaning. If enough people write government and enough people write other media sources, then things will change, because you keep the issue alive. And at the very least, it's such a catharsis just to be able to spill out your angst and your frustration in a letter. It's good psychotherapy, you know, to just do that. It's not even, it's not just a good political move. And we should be writing the CRTC and complaining about the fact that there should be more money being given to the CBC, and that the communications minister should resolve the strike very quickly by treating those workers with dignity.
And it's not true, even if there is always a continuation or a maintenance of this image that they're complaining about. They're complaining with their mouthful. It's not true. But hey, I don't want to pass this opportunity to also promote community radio. We're still there to provide you with some great journalism and reporting about people within the community, and you know, it's done by the community people. So
well,
you know,
I'm
it's
just
good
amazed.
In parallel.
Well, the thing is, Bianca, I mean, wouldn't it be nice if one day the municipal urban levels of government would turn around and recognize and support the communications du quartier and really support and reinforce the spirit of what Montreal is. And those are the communities. We have so many wonderful communities all over Montreal, and community radio is one of those. You know, it's something that the municipal level of government should be doing. I know there's constitutional problems with that. I just got back from a conference in Savannah, Georgia, where I spoke about municipal urban issues. And Canada, unfortunately, has no constitutional rights given to municipalities. And that's part of the problem, why it's so hard, you know, for things like community radio and community initiatives. You know, one of the things that Marilyn Waring and so many other feminists and other thinkers, you know, you think globally but act locally. And this is an example of how you can do this.
And women who have always got strong ties to networking and to their community and the local community, yeah. It's a good place to start, you know.
Yes.
It's like even to get involved within politics, you know, big politics seems to be like you said, the angst with the economy. It's like politics also scare women in a way. And, you know, municipal level is a good way to start to get involved within
the public politics. I think that women are so great politically because we understand power in a different way, so we don't have to worry about getting into a position of power in the traditional sense. We're very comfortable with the power we have. It's unfortunate that we're not recognized for it, but just look at the marvelous things that women do in terms of their power with their own lives. It just amazes me because I think we're all survivors. Mm-hmm. And what they do within their families and what they do when they are given a chance or an opportunity to exercise different forms and different types of power, whether it be in politics or as a Bell Canada operator or nurse or whatever it is that they do.
There's one issue that has been my initial questioning for this series, and I want to talk to you a little bit about that, is that the Essential Law Services, which has been created by René Lévesque in the 70s, has a tremendous impact on what seems to be mainly women's union. Teachers have striked last September, so a few months ago. Nurses have also done strike last year, and they have also done, you know, numerous strikes in the 80s because there has been a major restructuring in the healthcare. And the impact it has, it's like reducing the number of nurses, increasing the amount of responsibilities, and not giving them proper backup. So I'm asking you if you want to tell us a few words about this essential services legislation, which seems to affect, again, mostly predominantly women's union.
Well, you know what it is? It's this nonsense that it always never ceases to amaze me that when we're talking about essential services, I never see the government ordering police when the police are out on strike, and yet one would consider the police to be an essential service. I never see the government ordering doctors to go back to work, yet I consider doctors to be an essential service. But I do see the government sending nurses to go back to work, and the majority of them are women. And I do see the government thinking that teachers, you know, declaring teachers to be essential, and the majority of them are women. So that after a while you begin to just do the mathematical tally of all this, and you realize, no, this is a deliberate conspiracy that, you know, the government is using what appears to be logical arguments in terms of essential services, in fact, to order women back to work. There has never been a moment in Canadian history where women who worked as nurses, that nurses' strikes have never been told to go back to work. They've always been ordered to go back to work. Yet I can't think of one situation where doctors were ordered to go back to work or the police were ordered to go back to work. So it's just amazing how very selective they are in terms of what they consider to be essential services and who is easier to push around the most. They deliberately create divisions among the various union federations. They are not interested whatsoever in the quality of our nurses. Really touch me in particular because they've always been an abused group within the labor market as a whole, because if you do any comparative analysis of skills, you realize how terribly underpaid nurses are, that we're losing them. I mean, no nurse in her right mind, and we're losing our doctors and we're losing everybody else. In this kind of an environment, why should you stay? And where are they going? Globalization. They are reaping the benefits of going to the private medical system in the United States after we've spent all our money, public money, training our doctors and our nurses and our teachers why would anyone in their right mind stay here when they can earn twice as much in American dollars somewhere else? To do this, you know, it's not very smart for Quebec society, for Canadian society.
It's not only, though, a question of salary, I believe. It's probably more of a question of working condition. When, you know,
well, benefits, pension plans,
the work environment, you know, how stressful it is right now. Talk to, you know, I wish none of our listeners going to be sick in the coming weeks or months. But if you get a chance to meet or talk with nurses, the way the working atmosphere is right now is not just a question of salaries. That almost half of them are close to breakdown.
They can't do their job. I was reading something from the Canadian Nursing Federation, and 15 years ago, the ratio of nurse to patient was one nurse for every 5 patients. And today, it's one nurse for every 20 patients. So you talk about stress, they can't even do their job properly, just like teachers can't do their job properly. They shove more and more students into our classrooms like sardines. And the most important thing about teaching is contact, is coming to contact with a student so that you give them an opportunity to connect with you. Well, if you have an audience, then you're not teaching, you're performing. That's not learning. One cannot learn in that environment. You don't offer enough opportunity for discussion. There's too many people to engage in a dialogue or discussion. You can't do it with a crowd, you know? You just can't do it in a stadium, you know? It doesn't happen like this. Yeah, the working conditions of the public sector. I think you're also going to see a lot of tension, which is why the provincial government, because there's an election coming up, are trying and hope to delay the negotiation of the collective agreements in the public sector. I don't know whether you know this, but all the collective agreements in the public sector usually sort of terminate or come up around the same time, and it's this fall. Mm-hmm. So the Quebec government has asked them, please, could you wait on your negotiations? Because they'd like to do it, obviously, not in the middle of an election.
Yet it's in the middle of an election that the union would be really in a situation to bring into the public sphere or public debate the, you know, real situation of their workers and to demand debate for better conditions and better salary. But what I want to say coming to a closure is that we've seen or we've discussed how essential services law are affecting predominantly women's union and women's worker. And yet, even if we call it essential services, why is the pay not going where the words are? You know, if it's essential, if it's truly essential, why are we not giving them
even
the
more
monetary consideration?
I think we should be paying them more. After all, they're giving us an essential service.
Yes, but it's not the case. So,
it's
it's you know, a paradox in that sense.
I just want to say on your last statement there about nurses and the public sector and the essential services is that the public must support people that are on strike to let them know that they're not alone. One of the lovely things, again, that I love about Europe is that the support, for example, if the street guards went on strike in Paris, everybody would be on strike. In other words, the collective action would be so general to everyone who worked. We don't have enough support of people, those that are unionized as well as those that aren't unionized. They need that support when they do have problems. That's one of the things that's missing.
Mm-hmm. Well, Professor Maria Peluso, thank you very much for your contribution.
In 1999, Quebec nurses went on strike, but after 22 days, their action was declared illegal. 10 years before, women faced even worse legal maneuvering. when striking nurses lost 1 year of seniority for every day of the illegal strike. Just last fall, 80,000 teachers throughout Quebec walked out, and again, essential services laws were cited and teachers forced back to work.
In North America, the Industrial Revolution came through women workers.
Over the next 4 weeks, we'll take up these issues here on CKUT's Long-Term Memory Radio Project, Women's Labor History in Quebec and Canada, every Wednesday from 5 to 6 p.m., concluding on May Day.
Women have always been essential to the labor movement. The first unions that were formed by male-skilled workers who weren't admitting those women.
Hearts starve as well as bodies. Give us bread, but give us roll.
You've been listening to a conversation with Professor Maria Peluso with Bianca Allard. This is the conclusion of part three. Stay tuned for part four.
Ungrateful, ungracious eyes ogle at eighth wonderfuls, wonder fill small minds that make no time for sincerity. For sincerity. God fruit we, sugary, plentiful, not rib bone alone, soul, home, no, evil does not derive from my name, no, evil does not derive from my name. Fertilizer feeds the earth, but from the earth come the flowers, but from the earth come the flowers, the flowers. Ungrateful, ungracious eyes ogle at eighth wonderfuls, wonder fill small minds that make no time. Ungrateful, ungracious eyes ogle at eighth wonderfuls, wonder fill small minds that make no time for sincerity. Empty the pretend praise, raised brows and penises await response from fly Venuses, who grace each sidewalk square with a mastery of movement and mob. Misadmired by the masses. All they can or want to see are scantily clad asses that swing and beg to be slapped during self-satisfying sex. Say my name. Ain't no sisters or mamas here to protect, just bitches and tricks to catch in traps of covert compliments and Jesus judgment. Strong-willed women and divas seen as asking for it, homeworking whores with no morals. Sounds like Salem and slavery to me. Ungracious, ungrateful eyes ogle at eighth wonderfuls, wonder-filled small minds that make no time for sincerity. Ungrateful, ungracious eyes ogle at eighth wonderfuls, wonder-filled small minds. Make no time for sincerity, for sincerity, for sincerity. Now, I was born a slave, a rebel, an inherent queen. No thing, situation, or person can steal my birthright. I came forth in the night, a force to be unreckoned with. You sure you want to get with this? Some may attempt to falter my steps, knock me down, but I'm resilient. I just bounce, I just bounce. Bounce, bounce, bounce. Able to leap from small minds in a single bound. Land feet first on the ground. I abound with she-lectricity. I'ma sing my woman song, make you listen to me. I'ma sing my woman song, make you listen to me. Make you listen, make you listen. Why you covet my rhythm? Why you treat me like the unforgiven? Call me mystery, like the shroud of Turin. I'm more than, I'm more than. Boom, bap, boom, bap, boom, bap, boom, bap. ain't your doormat, your sugar tit, your own personal supply of bliss, your in-house ass to kick. Ungracious eyes, Agaletteth, wonderfuls, wonderful, small minds that make no time. Ungrateful, ungracious eyes, Agaletteth, wonderfuls, wonderful, small minds that make no time. Ungrateful, ungracious eyes, Agaletteth, wonderfuls, wonderful, small minds that make no time. Make no time, make no time, make no time, make no time for sincerity. For sincerity.